Hi, I'm Natalie, and welcome to Infinitely Irrational, where we discuss the real, eccentric, and complex history of math. In each episode, we unearth the wild stories behind some famous or not so famous mathematicians. Today, we continue our discussion about infinity and Georg Cantor, and this episode will attempt to answer the following questions. Are your choices really your own? If a hotel has infinite rooms, can there ever be no vacancy? What does this have to do with math? Let's find out. Hi, everyone. We are back to continue our conversation about Cantor and infinities. I would be remiss if I did not, at one point in this trilogy, say to infinity and beyond.
I think everyone was expecting that.
I thought about it after we finished recording the first episode, and I was like, God, missed opportunity. So we've been talking about Cantor. We've been talking about his groundbreaking theories. We talked about how there are infinite different sets with the same infinity. You know, we could sit here and record for infinite time. I give you a number, you multiply it by two. So it's the same infinity, countable infinity. So we'll chat a little more about, you know, his life and think about sets that have perhaps higher infinity than natural numbers. We're going to really upset the theologians of old in this episode. So welcome back, Ioana. I think I sat there and said all that stuff and didn't even say that you're here again. And that's because I'm the worst.
I think I accidentally intercepted me before you mentioned me, so...
Oh, good. Well, everybody should know by now.
So great to be back. Thank you so much. It's super fun as always, and infinity makes it like really cool. Yeah, and Cantor, very interesting mathematician that was religious himself. So when he was told off by the theologians, he took it at heart. He mostly studied at the University of Berlin, and he wanted to go back to work there, but he never managed to. He stayed in Halle his whole career. He did earn higher and higher positions there, but he never fulfilled like his dream to go to Berlin. His doctorate was on indeterminate equations of the second degree, and he was only 22 years old when he earned it. So he started his work on sets subsequently.
That's really cool. And what he studied at the University of Berlin, he studied physics, philosophy, and mathematics. And over the past like week or so, as I was thinking about like what are the different types of infinities and things like that, you know, there's sort of three categories of infinity. It's like the mathematical infinity, which is the countable ones, you know, that we sat there talked about. There's also in physics, there's like the stars and things like that. And then finally, there's the third type, which is more religious, like God is infinite. And I think it's really interesting that this gentleman, who his whole bag was infinity, at the University of Berlin, he studied those three things. And what's the thing that all of those subjects have in common is infinity. So I think that's really cool. And the second thing I wanted to say is that if you'll recall from the first episode, listeners, he didn't make it back to the University of Berlin, even though he wanted to do so. And that was really because of Kronecker. And so I really wanted to be like Newman, but like say it Kronecker, like from Seinfeld. So I just really wanted to throw some shade at Kronecker there, because who knows what would have happened if he had made it back to where he wanted to go.
Yeah, absolutely. Your point about what he studied and the combination of those three or their intersection even better is that what gave rise to these new ideas that are now recognized fully, of course, and that all this interaction that we've been talking about in previous episodes as well about maths and culture and maths and other aspects of life, and it's not a solitary endeavor and it has so many connections everywhere. And yes, of course, who knows what could have happened if he had the opportunity to go to a big university or maybe make Halle more famous because Halle had Cantor.
This leads really nicely into our next thing that we want to talk about, because he was the only member of the staff at the University of Halle to not adhere to a deterministic philosophy. So like the first time I heard this sentence, I was like, well, what the heck does that mean? And we had a conversation about it. So like, go ahead and set us up. Tell us what that means.
So determinism tells that when we make a certain decision or we take an action, it would have been impossible to make a different decision or take a different action. In other words, we cannot ever do something different to what we have done. It kind of goes against free will in a way, I guess.
And now this is interesting because the sentence we said right before was that he doesn't adhere to this. So essentially he's like, I'm going to write my own ticket. In my mind, I'm thinking, you know, closed mouth don't get fed. If you don't ask for it, you're not going to, you know, if you don't take the bull by the horns and like write your own life story, you think of like Hamilton or any of those things where it's like, I'm going to not give up my shot. I'm going to do what I want to do, right? Like, he is saying all of those things really, or adhering to that philosophy. But then why not be a violinist if he doesn't adhere to that? Or he wants to go to the University of Berlin. Why not find literally any way to do that? And again, I don't know. I'm what, centuries later looking at this, there are probably all these reasons, but it's interesting to me that if you are someone that thinks that, you know, no, I can kind of do anything I want or be anything I want or whatever, then why did you not do the things you wanted to do?
On one hand, I mean, that is a valid question, but also he might have done some things. He did go against the establishment of the mathematical community of the time. So maybe that non-adherence to the deterministic philosophy allowed him morally, perhaps. So he had to do something that is according to his own values, that managed to go against them. And he suffered a lot of consequences. He did not manage to have the career he dreamed. However, we all know about him today. So maybe that was an influence in his career and in his life anyway.
And, you know, you're exactly right on that. As I was going through it and thinking about it, it was like, you know, there are things I wanted to do in my life that I didn't do for whatever reason. And, you know, if centuries later, somebody else is doing whatever the 2200 version of podcasting is, and they're talking about my life, and they'd be like, well, why didn't she do thing X, Y, and Z? Why did she go to math? Why didn't she continue with theater? You know, or whatever the case may be. I mean, it's very easy, I think, to look back and be like, well, how come this? And so you're exactly right, because at the end of the day, he did. He discovered these infinities and he went against the math community and all those sorts of things. So we've talked a little about people that didn't like him. Let's talk about Hilbert. He was a great advocate of Cantor's work, and he even called it a paradise. He said, no one shall expel us from the paradise which Cantor created for us. You know, Hilbert here was a highly influential mathematician. The Königsberg Bridge problem that is famous, and you can go look it up if you want, but that's where he was born. And he died in Göttingen, and essentially that's the sort of ultimate mathematics hub for centuries. But Hilbert, one of our favorite things that we talked about is Hilbert's Infinite Hotel, which really nicely illustrates some of the points of Cantor's theory. So I know this is something that is special to you. So you take Hilbert's Infinite Hotel and tell us about it.
Oh, cool. Thank you so much. So there's this hotel with infinite rooms. That's the Infinite Hotel. And all the rooms are occupied. And if a new guest arrives, how would you accommodate them? You can move all of your guests to the room that's the number one more than the one they are. And you can always accommodate the one new guest. So you move everyone to the N plus one. So if they were in room 5, they go to room 6 and so on. So room 1 is free and accommodates the new guest. But then Hilbert asks, what happens when a bus containing infinite more guests arrives and they ask for rooms? So the guests are asked to move to the room number that is double their original number. So similar to the thought experiment we did last time, when we had a natural number, we multiplied by 2, we got an even number. So Open University in the UK has an amazing mini-series of videos called 60 Seconds Adventures in Thought, and they discuss Hilbert's Infinite Hotel in one of them. And I'll steal their joke shamelessly, because even though I've been video with my students for a decade or so, I always laugh. So to move to the room that is double your room number is easy. If you are in room 2, you just go to room 4. But it's not so easy if you go to the room with number 32,545,679. That's a long way to go. So this illustrates the properties of countable infinity beautifully. So this one-to-one correspondence between the naturals and the evens is obvious because the person originally had a room, they still had a room after infinite more guests arrived.
It was really funny. I love that video, the 60 seconds adventure in thought. But one of my favorite things about it is, and again, because I love food and that's like my priority, but they're like, in addition to upsetting them about having to move that far, is also like, you know, make sure you get down early for breakfast.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And then people get blasted and throw their trays. Really, really nice humor in those videos as well.
Right. They're great, man. They're great. But so, you know, once you get over sort of the, I don't want to say shock, but once you can kind of start to grasp the fact that the even numbers or any other infinite set of integer multiples of the naturals, like once you get over the fact that you start to process that it's as many as the naturals, you know, so the question is, well, so what's next? And naturally, we think about the rational numbers, which are the fractions, right? And call back to Pythagoras and the potential drowning, where it was like, you know, can you represent a number as a ratio of two numbers? So it's clearly easy to think about what the next natural number is. For example, what comes after 3 is 4, is 5, is 6, right? But which fraction comes after something like 1/2? Let's think of it as 0.5. So, you know, think of 1/2 as 0.5. Any terminating decimal, not something like pi, right? Because that's irrational, but any terminating decimal can be written as a fraction. So it's kind of easy to sort of make this transition. So if we have 0.5, what comes after 0.5?
That's a fantastic question because we start grasping how differently fractions behave to natural. So would we say it's 0.501? 0.5001 is even closer. Or 0.5, and we carry on saying until tomorrow 1, it's even closer. And we can keep going, finding terminating decimals, which are also written as fractions, closer and closer to 0.5, but it's practically impossible to find the exact next. I had suggestions from students in the past, what if we write 0.50 recurring 1? But clearly that's not possible because recurring means no end.
Exactly.
So there's nowhere to put that 1. So we cannot have that. It doesn't stand logically as a symbol.
Which, consider the fact that they're thinking about infinity in infinity, but it can't be infinite. That's cool. That's like Inception.
Oh, no, I value those answers. They're amazing. I mean, they attest their good thinking process. But that's how we get to more interesting stuff as well. So we cannot find the next larger fraction. So that means that it is impossible to arrange the fractions in ascending order. And that's just something that we cannot do. And I hope everyone is convinced of this. Cannot fractions in ascending order. Not possible.
So what does this mean? Does this mean that fractions have the next bigger infinity?
Well, maybe we cannot place them in order of size. Maybe there is a different way we can arrange them and still put them in one-to-one correspondence with the naturals. So putting things in ascending order or order of size will be one way of arranging them, but it's not the only way. And Cantor came up with an amazing idea of how to arrange fractions, even if it's impossible to put them in order of size.
So you have in your book, in Mathematical Adventures, Asuka's got a really good illustration. So listeners, again, I cannot tell you enough how great the book is and the illustrations. I mean, I still am dying about Tycho Brahe and the toilet paper. That remains, it's got the top spot for me. But anyways, let's try and describe it with audio.
Absolutely, we'll do our best. So what Cantor thought was, let's put all the fractions with a numerator of 1 on the first row. So you have 1 over 2, 1 over 3, 1 over 4, 1 over 5. When we start with 1 over 1.
Now, you know what? I'm imagining that we get all the way to the end and we write 1 over infinity, which is going to annoy some people. Because then we need into other things.
Absolutely.
And we certainly don't do 1 over 0.
Definitely not that. So we put dot, 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 and 1 over 0 is not infinity.
No, we don't start with 1/0. No, we start with 1/1 and we go to ...
Yeah, exactly. No, I think when I was saying them, I started with 1/2. That's why I corrected myself. So then the second row has 2/1, 2/2, 2/3, and so on.
What do you think about 2/4? Should 2/4 be there or should it be in the first row?
That's an interesting question. So it wouldn't affect the one-to-one correspondence in the end, because if you consider the 2/4, if you say, if I have an equivalent fraction, if something can be simplified to something that came up before I cross it out, I have one-to-one correspondence. If I don't cross it out, I still have a one-to-one correspondence. So my guess is that it wouldn't make any difference. But now we're spoiling the end because...
Oh, no, I'm sorry. Guys, spoiler alert. Okay, I'll be quiet.
Infinity of the fractions. So we carry on like that, the third row, 3/1, 3/2, and so on. And each column will have a consistent denominator. So the first column, we have all the denominator of 1, second column, denominator of 2, and so on. So this structure will go on forever. And the point is that we can find any fraction we want with no problems. If we want, for example, to locate 473/859, all we have to do is go to the 473rd row and 859th column, and there it is. So we have an arrangement of all the fractions, even though not in order of size. And then we just assign to these fractions their position. So we use the natural numbers of their position, and we move in kind of like a snake pattern in it from 1/1 to 1/2, down to 2/1, and then down and across, and so on, and doing some horizontal and vertical movements and some diagonal movements. So we have a 1/1 to 1 correspondence with the naturals in terms of position, instead of in terms of size.
Which, based on that, we would not then remove 2/4, because then you wouldn't be able to go to the second column and the fourth to find it. Or like if you went to 2/5, that would shift it back one. So we would have to leave all of them as they are.
We could. Or we could say we use it as a stepping stone, but don't count me.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's definitely a fair question to consider. So there we go. Cantor, with this structure that he created, showed that all rational numbers or fractions are as many, have the same infinity as the natural numbers are also countably infinite. So the multiples of a trillion are of the same infinity as the fractions. And that's, I don't know, I find that proper mind-bending stuff.
I mean, it's amazing. You love thinking about infinity. Well, not you, but me. I mean, all of us, I guess, you know, plural ustedes, everybody. So when's the next infinity going to come up, right? We keep finding more and more sets of numbers with countable infinity, infinite, frankly, of those actually, but nothing bigger just yet. The next set of numbers that we're going to explore are going to be the real numbers. And remember, the requirement for countable infinity is that it's in a one-to-one correspondence with the natural numbers. What we just talked about with Hilbert's hotel, with the you're moving from room 2 to room 4 or room like whatever million to like who knows what, right? And so now what we're going to do for this is we're going to attempt a proof by contradiction. And I want to explain a little bit, just very loosely, if you're not a math person, sort of what this means. If you think about an alibi in a murder case, right, they're saying that the proof that this person is not the murderer is because it would be a contradiction for them to have done it because they were with me very clearly doing this other thing, right? So you can't be in two places at once, unless, of course, there's some way that you can, you know, teleport or something like that, which I don't think we have yet. But let's go ahead now, Ioana, and share the proof by contradiction for this.
Wonderful. I love your idea on the contradiction for like everyday life kind of situation. Well, not that murders are everyday life, but you know what I mean. So let's assume we're going to start with an assumption and then we're going to show that how that assumption cannot stand. So we assume that the real numbers are in a one-to-one correspondence with the naturals and then arrive to a contradiction, hence proving that they're more reals than naturals. So I'm not sure if these words have plurals, like reals and naturals.
They do now. It is canon.
So I like the part of the proof, which is very showy, offy, like to show off. We will even show that the real numbers between 0 and 1 are more than the naturals. So we have as many fractions as we have naturals. However, we have more real numbers between 0 and 1 than we have naturals. If any listeners have a bit of pen and paper and want to jot this down, it might be fun, but you really don't have to. So let's try and say that the first number on the list that's matched with 1 is, say, 0.2839399.
Hold on, I'm writing this down. Hang on, let me get a piece of paper. Okay, so we're doing 0.2839399. Okay, I wrote it down.
Then the number we will match with 2 in our one-to-one correspondence kind of list is 0.7472929. These are very random numbers that we came up with. It doesn't matter exactly which numbers you use. The one that we match with 3 would be 0.82427949-7842. Again, doesn't matter. We match it with 3. And then we match 0.983939322 with 4. So we assign them a number as just part of a list. And we assume that this list goes on forever. Again, it is a one-to-one correspondence to infinity. We'll try and create a new number that we will show that cannot be part of that list. So that's the very creative part where we can say maths is a bit creative as well. So the new number we're going to create is we're going to take the first digit of the first number in the list and we'll add 1 to it. So our first number, the first after the decimal point was 2. So the number we're creating starts with 0.3. Then we take the second number from the list and we add 1 to the second digit of that number. Then we take the third number of that list and we add 1 to the third digit of that number. And then we take the fourth and we add 1 to the fourth digit and so on. And we have this agreement that if the digit was 9, when we add 1, we're going to be turning that into a 0.
Okay, so in our case, you know, the first number would be 0.38, blah, blah, blah. The second one would be 0.75, blah, blah, blah. The first one would be 0.825, blah, blah, blah. And the fourth one would be 0.9830, blah, blah, blah. Yes?
Yes. So we will only take the first digit from the first number, then the second digit from the second number, then the third digit from the third number, the fourth from the fourth, and so on and so forth, say to infinity. So the new number we are creating will only contain the digits 0.3890 and so on, whatever the fifth digit plus 1. Once we've created this new number that had all the corresponding digits, one bigger than the original, then we check if it could have been part of our list. And it couldn't have been the first number on the list because it differs in the first digit. It could be the second because it would be different in the second. It couldn't have been the 100th because it would be the different in the 100th digit and so on. So by doing this, we created a new number that cannot have been on the original list. So the one-to-one correspondence finally crashes. And we say, there cannot be one one-to-one correspondence between the naturals and the real numbers, or even the real numbers between 0 and 1. And this is the first infinity that we know of that is bigger than the countable infinity.
And this is called the continuum. And real numbers seem to be sort of the first set of numbers that have this higher infinity than the natural numbers. And if you think back to what we were talking about before, where it was like Cantor upsetting theologians, well, if we're talking about, you know, what Kronecker said about integers are the work of God and everything else is the work of man, and, you know, how can anything be bigger than God? Like, this right here is the moment where he said, essentially, this is bigger than God. And this right here is the moment where everybody had their feelings about infinity. So I think that this is a really good thing to just kind of process, because what we've done here is now we've upset all the theologians of yore.
Yeah, so that must have been quite an exciting time when he stumbled across that and thought, oh, what's happening here? Then the question, of course, is, okay, we stumble across the continuum and there's a proof that it's bigger than the natural numbers. Is there anything between countable infinity and the continuum? And there's a bit more of shocking news to come. They came a bit later, actually, by American mathematician Paul Cohen and Austro-Hungarian and subsequently American mathematician, as we've spoken before, that said, well, we don't know, but if it does or if it doesn't affect the mathematical principles that we're working with so far, which is very strange. And I don't think people expect maths to say, it doesn't matter, we don't care.
That's true. This right here is very interesting because we think about the fact that math is unshakable. You know, it's like we build upon the axioms. It is, and that is the only way it is accepted in math. And then, you know, we talked last episode or earlier in this one, I can't recall, but we talked about the fact that Kronecker and some of the other people were annoyed at the lack of examples and the fact that, like, why do we need these other things? And now here we have Paul Cohen saying, well, it doesn't matter. But everybody else saying, but then why doesn't it matter? Yes, it most certainly does matter because this is math.
Exactly. So just to clarify, when we say it does not matter or it's an undecidable statement, it means that if it is true, so if there's nothing between them or if there is something between them, it does not affect the functioning of the rest of the mathematical kind of edifice.
Sure, but certainly to say the words, it doesn't matter, and especially with such a controversial topic, I think is all lending itself to why maybe some of these arguments were coming up.
Definitely. And also it's that safety of the mathematical certainty that is undecided and that it's really unexpected.
So as it sits, right, as you said, it's undecidable. And as we just talked about, it took a long time for mathematicians to accept this as a possibility. And I would argue that we still struggle with the idea of it. Like, we still struggle with the concept of infinity. Like, what does that mean? Every time you hear the word infinity or like you see it in any branch of math, it's like, okay, now we have to think about it. Like, think about L'Hôpital's rule or whatever it is, right? Like, infinity is still sort of this big nebulous thing that takes a long time to sort of get your mind wrapped around.
Definitely. But we have promised infinite infinities. And after all this really arduous work, we still only have two. So where do all the other infinities come from then?
Well, next time we're going to chat about the concept of a power set and how it lends itself to a cute little proof on multiple infinities, each one bigger than the one before. With that, we will close this episode out. Again, Ioana, thank you so much for joining us, or joining me, I guess, the mathematical we. But certainly always love talking to you and can't wait to chat about power sets.
Cool. Thank you so much for having me. It's really fun. And can't wait for the multiple more infinities next episode. Yay!
Thanks for joining us for today's episode of Infinitely Irrational. Can't get enough of the math and the fun? Visit us on the web at infinitelyirrational.com for the math and research behind the stories. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, or email at podcast@infinitelyirrational.com. If you love this episode, subscribe, follow, and share. See you soon for the next one.